Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
In 1956, Nate Saint flew a plane with four other missionaries into the jungles of Ecuador, daring to make contact with the most dangerous tribe known to man at that time, the Waldoni people, also known as Alca, or Naked Savage. After several months exchanging gifts with the Alcas, the five men were attacked with spears and machetes and killed. The warrior who delivered the final fatal spear to Nate Saint was a warrior named Minkayi. Steve Saint was 5 years old when his father died, but today he entrusts his grandchildren to Minkayi's care. It's an amazing story of forgiveness that's since been made into a book and a film, but the man himself is with us to tell us the story. Steve Saint, welcome to Open House.
Hey, thanks a lot, Sheridan. It's nice to be with you down under.
It's amazing how this story has gone right around the world. Anybody who maybe has read any of Elizabeth Elliot's books, Through Gates of Splendor and other books, would know, of course, of Jim Elliot's story. And many people who have either read the book or seen the film The End of the Spear will have known of you and your father's story.
You know what? I just came back from Brazil. I was at two tribal conferences, one with 49 different tribes represented. And I was very surprised that the Indians wanted to have their pictures taken with me, and I finally asked one, I said, "Why do you want to have your picture taken with me?" And he said, "Oh, because of Terra Salvaje," which is savage land in Portuguese, and it's the name of the end of the spear down there in Portuguese is Terra Salvaje. And he said, "Because I'm a true tribal person, soy indígena," he said, "I'm truly indigenous, but it's hard for me to convince people. But if I have my picture taken with you and people know that you're from Terra Salvaje, then they'll know that I'm truly a tribal person." Huh. So for me, tribal people were wanting their picture taken with me, and I look very North American, although I'm actually Ecuadorian. Yeah. So it has. It's gone all over the Amazon and through Africa and whatnot.
Well, we need to touch on the original story, because, of course, that's the foundation of everything that's happened since. Here we had the Ecuadorian Five, as they've been known, and your father, indeed, is one of those. And you were 5 years old when you lost your dad. And how did you feel as a five-year-old when you did get the news of your dad's death?
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't know if you're familiar with the book. This is fairly popular with children here in the U.S. It's called It Was Alexander's Awful, Terrible, Very Bad, No Good Day. And
no,
that, when my dad died, that was Stevie Saint's Awful, Terrible, Very Bad, No Good Day. Mm. It was really devastating to me because my whole life revolved around my dad. He was my hero. The only thing that I wanted was to grow up and be like him.
Mm. The amazing thing is that after that humongous loss in your life, the great story of the five killed missionaries is that their wives and their children, you, your mother included, went back to live with the very tribe that killed them.
It's a little bit different than that, but not terribly. It was my aunt, my dad's sister, Rachel, who went in to live with the Waodani. Now, we stayed living down there on the edge of the jungles, just 60 miles away from where my dad was killed. But it was Elizabeth Elliot, Jim Elliot's wife, and my aunt, my dad's sister, who went in 2 years after Dad and Roger and Pete and Ed and Jim were killed to live with the Waodani. And then 2 years later, my aunt talked my mom into letting me go out to live with her for a period of time. So I met these people when I was, I was eight, maybe just about the time I turned nine.
Okay. And did you know at the time then that these were the people who actually were responsible for your father's death?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when my mom told me that my aunt was going to go in and live with them, well, really, Aunt Rachel, and I called Elizabeth Aunt Betty, I mean, I thought surely that Aunt Rachel was going to be killed too, and it just didn't make any sense to me as a little boy that after they'd already killed my dad and four men that I called uncle, that my aunt was going to go in and try to live with them, and I was sure they would kill her too. Mm. So I was cognizant of what was going on. It mystified me, but when my aunt wasn't killed, then I just couldn't wait to meet them.
Right. Is that right? I was going to ask, you know, how you as an eight-year-old felt then, meeting this very tribe.
You know, people wonder that. For me, Sheridan, it was, I mean, this was exciting stuff because I was convinced by then that these were the most special people on earth. I mean, consider that my dad and his four friends all had guns, And although the Waurani might have attacked them from ambush, which they always do, they might have been able to spear one or two of them. But whether or not they would have killed them or not, who knows? But Dad and his friends certainly could have defended themselves against the attack.
Mm.
So I knew when they were all five killed, I knew that they had allowed themselves to be killed. And later on, the Waurani told me that one of them, you know, had a pistol. They didn't know what a pistol was then, but they realized they had his arm up in the air and he was shooting. And that was after he had already been speared by Nampa. So somebody else had a gun in the plane and shot, bullet that went right through the windshield. So I knew that they had decided that they would rather die than kill the Waurani. And then my Aunt Rachel, I mean, she didn't have to go in. The fact that she was willing to go in and risk her life to live with these people, then I knew they were special. And after my dad was killed, every night when we got together for, you know, a family time, my mom would pray for the very people who had killed my dad and her husband. And I just figured nobody would do these things unless these were very, very important people. So I wanted to meet them.
Yeah. What were the emotions going through the Waurani people's minds themselves, the warriors themselves, when they actually did attack your father and the four other missionaries? Were they just defending themselves?
No. I mean, it's a fairly complex story, although I can give you the thumbnail sketch. Where they landed was quite a ways away, but the Waurani heard the plane landing there. It was right along a hunting trail. So a bunch of them went and looked through the jungle and saw my dad and Roger and Pete and Ed and Jim. But they went back to their village. But then one young man and a young woman and an older woman went back to go to the beach. The young woman's name was Gimare. The old woman's name was Mintaka. And the young warrior's name was Nankiwi. Well, Nankiwi had already been given a wife that the other men had speared. Then they gave him a wife that he drowned. Then they gave him another wife, and he was a very young man. I mean, he might have been 20 or so. The third wife, he still was married to. He had two children by, but he wanted to marry this young Gimare. But her brother didn't want her to marry Nankiwi. He wanted her to marry Dewey because the brother was going to marry Dewey's sister. You know, they were going to exchange brother and sister.
Mm.
And the brother didn't want him to marry. The mother didn't want her to marry. But he went there with her, and then after they were there on the beach most of the day, then the two of them snuck off in the jungles by themselves. So the following day, when the group from the village wanted to come and see if these three had been killed or not by the foreigners, they found this young warrior and this young girl who had been told not to marry, and they were alone together in the jungles. So it was clear that either the brother was going to kill Nankiwi or Nankiwi was going to have to kill the brother, and then that would start a whole new round of killings. So the oldest man in the group, he knew they couldn't afford to have any killings within their family group, so he said, if we're going to kill, let's go kill the foreigners. And that's really why they went. No, they went with the intention to ambush them and to kill them all or to die trying.
Wow. This is Open House right across Australia. Steve Saint is with us. The End of the Spear is the book and the movie that tells his story, and of course the story of his father, Nate Saint, one of the five very famous now missionaries who were killed in Ecuador back in 1956. But the story of forgiveness that flows out of that is quite amazing. So, Steve, just give us a picture of the Waurani's way of life before their embrace of Christianity. We're going to get to that point soon, but already you've painted a picture of retaliation, retaliatory killings. What else marked their life? How did they live?
Well, they were hunter-gatherers and gardeners. They had little gardens, but they got most of their food then and still do today by hunting wild game and fishing in the rivers out there in the Amazon basin where they live. They were nomadic. They had no chief, no elders, no social structure other than the family, the immediate family. And because they had no structure, there was no authority, no police, no government, no taxes, no rules, really, except for a couple of cultural norms of things. No adult that I have ever heard has ever told another adult what to do. That they're so egalitarian that to tell somebody else what to do is a violation of somebody's autonomy and is reason to kill that person. So consequently, they were extremely violent, had a homicide rate of over 60% over five generations that have now been studied by anthropologists going back, you know, asking them questions into the back. They killed all outsiders that came into their territory. Outsiders would shoot them on sight. And they killed between two sections of the tribe, upriver and downriver. They killed also between clans, the upriver killing upriver and downriver killing downriver. And then they also killed within their own family groupings.
Oh, dear. So, certainly trust and forgiveness weren't to be found within the Wadoni.
No, they don't even, to the best of my knowledge, they have no concept of forgiveness.
Yeah.
Or didn't back then.
You mentioned some ethnographic studies that were actually being done. I heard that one particular study done on the Wadoni actually suggested they were facing extinction too.
Oh, I don't think there's any. I mean, I'm not a professional anthropologist, but within the tribe, their marriage patterns establish that they were really headed for extinction, and that is that within the tribe, the only proper marriage is to marry a cross cousin. Now, that means that you could marry your father's sister's children or your mother's brother's children, but you couldn't marry parallel cousins. You couldn't marry your father's brother's children or your mother's sister's children. Hmm. At fiestas or parties, a man could sleep with his wife or with any of her sisters, so they had a taboo against marrying your father's sister's children because they could be your half-brothers or sisters, or your mother's sister's children. But you also, it was considered immoral to marry somebody that wasn't within your family grouping, because if you did that, then your children would have enemies on both sides of the family, and their chances of survival would be almost nothing. Of the men who killed my dad, Kimo was married. His wife, he took in a spearing raid. She wasn't from his clan. So that was considered an immoral marriage, and means that there was nobody for him to marry. So he had to go kill people to steal a wife. Minkai is married to a wife that he stole. Gikita was married to one. Dabo was married to one. So really, right there is four men out of six, seven mature warriors in the Gikitaidi clan who had all taken their wives by killing other people. And when they would go to steal wives, they would try to kill the whole family other than the girls they stole, so there was nobody left to come and retaliate and carry out a vendetta against them. So, no, there's really no question. The group was getting so small that it was very difficult to find proper relationships within which to marry, which meant that the killing was actually accelerating.
Yeah, dear me. This is what annoys me a little bit when in popular parlance, the word missionary is often associated with somebody who comes and destroys a culture. We forget the fact that for so many of these tribal groups, they were killing themselves, and the message that the missionaries brought actually brought a real change. I want to get to that in a second. But firstly, what was their understanding, the Wadoni's understanding of the creator and the spiritual world?
Well, they call the creator Wangungi, which means the creator being. They knew that there was a creator because there was a creation, and they knew they were familiar with the spirit world. They were afraid of evil spirits, and they knew a lot more about the evil spirits than they did about Wangungi. All they knew of Wangungi was that he had created everything, but he was off. They couldn't figure out who he was. But they did know that they had some relationship with Wangungi, and that was because they never knew how to make stone axes. They were Stone Age people. They chopped down the trees in their gardens with stone axes. They had to have those stone axes, but they never learned to make them. They would just find them in the jungle. And if you ask even today, if you take a stone axe head, which is called a wanka, and you say, Kini, what is this? The typical Wadoni will say Wangungi. They'll say the creator instead of axe head, because their association with the stone axe head was that God gave that to them, the creator gave that to them so that they could live. So they knew that the creator wanted them to go on living, but he didn't reveal himself to them. And then the evil spirits, you know, they tried to appease evil spirits. They tried to flee from the evil spirits. They were afraid of the evil spirits, and they had, people now call them shamans, but witch doctors who interacted with the evil spirits and could cast spells on people and kill them. To the best of my knowledge, in the Waorani culture, there was no favorable or positive connotation to the witch doctor, the shaman. They only did bad.
Yeah. So then the Waodani actually turn around and start listening to the very message that the wives and the children of those five original missionaries had actually come to bring. Now, that's a story in itself, and probably people need to go and read the books to get a little bit more of a background as to how they came around to doing that. But what change, then, did a relationship with Jesus actually bring to the tribe, the Waodani?
Well, this gets a little bit tricky, and to be fair and not jump to conclusions, because you're absolutely right. When this new information came in that Wangungi actually could be known, that he had marked a trail and that there were taboos that Wangungi said people shouldn't do, things like they shouldn't kill each other, that suddenly gave them an authority within their culture that they, you know, if somebody powerful enough to make the creation says, I say no to killing, well, then that gives you a good reason to stop killing. These people didn't kill because they liked killing. They killed mostly because they would get angry, but a larger part of the reason was that you only had two choices. You either killed and lived, or you were killed and died. It wasn't a matter of, hey, guys, what do you say we stop the killing? You know, there were old vendettas going way back, and if you carried out all the vendettas, everybody would be dead. So they had to have some authority. So when the gospel came in and my aunt started telling them about Wangungi, that it was possible to know Wangungi through his carvings, or what they call the Bible, the people listened very attentively. But now, don't jump to the conclusion that everybody decided to follow this new trail. What everybody did do, almost without exception, was this gave them a reason to give up the vendettas. You know, if my family had killed yours a couple of generations ago, and then yours had killed mine more recently, I would have still a vendetta against you, and you would still have a vendetta against me. We'd have reason to kill each other. But if all of a sudden somebody comes in who is capable of doing us both in and says, listen, you guys, Steve and Sheridan, enough killing, done, then we would have a reason to stop, to let go of the vendetta.
Yeah.
And so the killing almost entirely stopped very, very quickly. I mean, almost immediately within the groups that heard the gospel, which was primarily, at least initially, the Gikitedi clan. But it doesn't mean that everybody became, you know, good little Christians. That wasn't the case. They accepted this change in their culture because they had no other way to survive. But that also made people very interested. Tell us more about Wangungi. What else does Wangungi say? And when they found out that Wangungi had actually, instead of carrying out a vendetta against people, he actually sent his son down here, and his son was killed, and yet Wangungi, instead of killing the people that killed his son, he accepted them and revealed that he had actually sent his son to die, because that was the only way that he could stop this vendetta of sin, was to say, okay, now I'm going to send my son, you kill him, and I won't be angry, and I won't kill you back, and that will make a way to stop this alienation between us. And when they heard that, they said, wow, that is really incredible. First of all, they couldn't even contemplate living in peace, much less somebody sacrificing for them. But they realized that it could happen because they saw five kawuri, five foreigners who came and had guns, and instead of killing them, they allowed themselves to be killed. And that created a huge dilemma in their thinking. They knew there's something different, there's some new information. And when they heard what it was that Wangungi said, if you're my follower, then you do what I did, where we would rather give than get, where we would rather die than kill. And they had seen an earthly example of that, and so they said, okay, we accept that. We shouldn't kill each other.
Wow. Steve Sanders, our guest on Open House right across Australia, theopenhouse.net.au for the podcast. Steve's father, Nate, was one of the five missionaries killed in Ecuador back in 1956. We're hearing about the ramifications that have happened since, quite a legacy. So jumping ahead to the story, you grew up in Ecuador. You get older. You move to the United States to study. You become a businessman. But you end up moving back to that Ecuadorian jungle at one stage, 1995, I actually think. Why did you go back?
Because the tribe told me to. Uh-huh. When my aunt moved into the Waodani territory 2 years after my dad was killed in about this time of the year in 1958, so 50 years ago. In fact, 50 years ago, yeah, this month. She lived there the rest of her life. She died of cancer finally at the age of, I think, 82. And I went down to help my jungle family bury her. And then they said it was time for me to come back. And I said that adults can't tell other adults what to do. And by this time, I was definitely an adult. But they did have the right as family to require that I would go live with them in order that with more people living in a clearing, their chances of being attacked by other people was greatly reduced. Now, that was in the old days. But now they still, if they feel threatened, they still can exercise that cultural norm. And they were doing that. They weren't asking me. They were telling me. And it was because people from the outside world, anthropologists, environmentalists, oil companies, and even missionaries and adventurers, had all been coming into their territory, and they knew that their children and others were really losing their identity, and they were afraid that they were going to lose their territory. And so finally, this clan that I had been adopted into said, "We say come and living with us, you teach us." And I said, "What do you want me to do?" And they said, "We want you to come and teach us to do things that you've learned living with the foreigners, so that we can do for ourselves and we can do for our own people." And the medicine thing, the tooth thing, they wanted to be able to fly, and they wanted to be able to share this faith that some of them had adopted and had changed their lives. They wanted to change or share that with the rest of their tribe. So I had two choices. I didn't have to go, because in egalitarian society, I could say bah, I could say no. But if I did say no, not only would it alienate them, but it would mean that I was, for some reason, rejecting my family. Not only would that sever my relationship with them, but, you know, there's a good chance if you ask a family member to come and live with you for mutual protection and they say no, you know, one conclusion might be that they actually have sided with your enemies and they're planning to kill you themselves, in which case the best thing for you to do is kill them before they can kill you. So I didn't want to sever my relationship with the tribe, so talked to my wife, Jenny, and we and our four children packed up and sold our last business and loaned our house to a single mother, and we moved back to Ecuador. At least it was back for me. It was the first time for Jenny and our four children.
Yeah. Wow. You mentioned before.
Yeah, wow.
I mean, that's huge. I mean, yeah, just the turnaround that would have been for your wife and for your children, let alone for you. And you stayed for 18 months, was it?
Just about 2 years for me, a year and a half for my family.
Wow.
And then we only left because we realized the things they wanted me to teach them, we really needed to develop in another place. And because I began to realize that if I stayed, they were going to become dependent on me, yes. And that was exactly what they didn't need.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned there that if you had said no to this demand, really, well, I was going to say request, it wasn't actually a request, a demand for you to come back, it would be like you were turning your back on your family. Now, key word there, I mean, these people had become your family, which leads to this relationship that you now have with Minkayi, who was the very man who dealt the final fatal spear wound to your father and killed him. At what stage did you two become friends?
That happened quickly after I went into the jungles. I mean, I hadn't been out there but, probably weeks when I began to realize that this one warrior, Minkayi, was treating me in a special way. And I didn't know, though, until just, I guess, couple of years ago, 2.5 years ago, what actually happened. My mom died about 3 years ago now. My sister found some of her correspondence, found a letter from my aunt in which Aunt Rachel wrote and said that one day Minkai came to Aunt Rachel's house, and he was really pretty worked up, and he said, "What's wrong with your boy? He's totally ignorant. He doesn't know how to do anything. He can't track animals. He can't shoot the blowgun. He doesn't know how to make poison for his darts. And he can't throw a spear." And they just thought, you know, how could somebody be 8, almost 9, and I probably looked more like I was about 17 height-wise out there. And finally Minkai said, "Who's going to teach your boy to live?" And Aunt Rachel said that she said to him, "Minkai, you having spear killed his father, who do you say should teach him to live?" And then she said, "Minkai left, and then he came back, and when he came back, he said, Nemo, it's true. Having spear killed his father, I myself will teach him to live." So he started treating me like a son and started teaching me the skills which I needed to live out there, but also the skills, frankly, that would have been my right to use to kill Minkai or members of his family in retaliation for him killing my dad.
Would he have been expecting that, some sort of retaliation from you?
Well, it was the way they had lived for years and years and years, except for those who began to walk God's trail or, you know, who had willingly given up their vendettas. But he had no idea whether when I grew up I would give up my vendetta against him or not.
Yeah, and so had he actually decided to walk God's trail, as you put it, by this stage?
He had, yes. Yeah. He did that not long, I think, before I went out to the jungle.
Yeah. Now, how did you go then as a young guy, and here's your father's killer befriending you and you developing this kind of friendship? Was there ever a time where you were sitting down next to each other and he was teaching you how to sharpen spears or whatever it might have been, and you just thought, "This isn't my friend, this is my dad's killer"?
You know, by the time that, you know, that would have occurred to me, I already loved him and felt loved by him. And, you know, it seems rather odd because your father probably was not killed, right?
Mm.
And you live in a culture where if somebody kills somebody there, and it probably becomes a big deal in newspaper, and, you know, it's because it's unusual. But down in the culture in which the Waurani existed and that I was now living in with them, most of my friends' fathers, if their fathers were dead, they had been killed too, and there were more whose fathers had been killed than whose fathers were alive. So having had my father killed made me more one of them than it distinguished me from them. I mean, I'd hear the old people talking, and they would be talking about who speared who and how they speared them and how they caught them unawares at night and rushed into the longhouse and started spearing everybody. And they were talking about people right there in the clearing whose families had been killed by other people living right there in the clearing. You know, their old way was they killed each other. The new way was that they gave up their vendettas. And so it wasn't that unusual for me to be sitting with or eating with or anything else with the man that killed my father. That was, I mean, it wasn't the norm necessarily, but it was commonplace in the village where I was living.
Yeah. So, Steve, I mean, just that the phrase that we've been talking about, giving up your vendettas, obviously forgiveness is a big theme in your life and what you've actually discovered through this. If you were to bring your life story down to two or three big lessons, what would they be?
Oh, man, you don't realize I'm 57. I would say one is this, that it's an understood fact that hurt people tend to hurt people. You know, we say hurt people, but there's another corollary that forgiven people forgive people.
Mm.
People that really know that they've been forgiven are much more likely to forgive. So that would be one. The other one would be that, and this one I learned from Grandfather Minkai just in these last years, he would say everybody has to decide whether they're going to walk their trail or whether they're going to walk Wangungi Taro, or whether they're going to walk God's trail. And he said, you need to think very carefully about this, because when you get to the end of your own trail, your name isn't written there. And at first, when I was translating for him, and he said that, I didn't understand what he meant. But he said, but if you walk Wangungi Taro, the trail that God sent his son down to mark with his own blood. When you get to the end of that trail, he has marked your name there. And then I realized that when Minkai and I travel around, I mean, he thinks I'm the greatest thing since peanut butter, because whenever he gets hungry, he tells me that his stomach is hurting, and I just pull over to one of my friends' houses, and they give us food through the window, you know, like McDonald's and Burger King. And he can't see any reason why those people, they always greet me, oh, hey, how you doing? And, you know, they give us food. So he's just thinking, I have friends everywhere. But what he was really keying off of is at night, I mean, we're traveling across the country, and I just go to my friend's house, and my friends have huge houses, and we go in there, and all I have to do is I walk through the front door, and I go over to this long counter, and there's always somebody standing there or looking at television. He thinks it's television, a computer. And I speak my name to them, and I say, hi, I'm Steve Saint, checking in. Now, he doesn't know what any of that means, but he knows that Steve Saint is my name. And when I do that, they look on their television, their computer, and if they see my name written there, then they get this big smile on their face. They say, yes, Steve Saint and Minkai Wawa. And I say, yes, this is Minkai. And then he knows, man, you ought to see Minkai smile, because he knows then what's going to happen. They give us these little plastic things which allow us to get into rooms, and there's refrigerators in there, and there's candy and cookies, and we can go down to the swimming pool, and in the morning there's food. And what he's saying to the foreigners is, listen, you can walk your own trail, but how dumb can you be? I mean, like, stupid. There's a movie that we watch with the kids all the time. This guy's always saying, stupid, yeah. Stupid. And Minkai is basically saying, how stupid could you be to walk your own trail? I mean, now remember, he's coming from a culture that's totally free.
Yeah.
Freedom is absolute. If you want to kill your neighbor, even today, you can go kill him. There's no law. There's no penalty, unless, of course, you're the person that you killed, their family comes and decides to kill you.
Right.
He's saying, man, freedom is not free at all. When you're totally free, everybody's totally free. And what he's saying is, you are free to walk your trail, but when you get to the end, nobody's ever been there, and there's nothing waiting for you. It's just empty. But he said, but if you walk Wengung Itaro, the trail that Itota marked with his blood, if you follow that trail, when you get to the end, he's marked your name, and all you have to do when you get there is you just walk up to the front counter and you just say, hey, I'm Sheridan. I'm checking in. And they say, they look in their book where Itota has written the names of all of those who decide to follow his trail. And when they find your name, then they look up and they give you this plastic thing, and you get to go and live with God forever, happily.
That's wonderful. Oh, that is wonderful, isn't it? That's absolutely gorgeous. Well, Steve, it has been a wonderful half hour or so that we've just spent with you, and I do appreciate your time. And I do appreciate the fact that, I mean, all of this came as a result of a bloody vendetta, and the fact that your father lost his life so that this wonderful story, the story that you've actually just told there, has actually been able to turn around for certainly the beginning of something absolutely beautiful. It really is the truth of what Jesus said, that it's unless a seed falls to the ground that there will be some sort of harvest, some sort of beautiful crop that will come as a result.
And you know, it makes sense. Now, my dad is buried out in the jungles. My aunt is buried out in the jungles. My best friend in the Waodani tribe, he went to share this good news that changed his life with his own family. He had killed and kidnapped in a spearing raid, and he went down there, and he knew they were going to kill him. He called on two-way radio and said, I think they're going to spear me, but he wouldn't flee because he wanted them to have this information, and they speared him. I just had dinner with a woman whose husband and two boys were burned alive in India by Hindus.
Yes.
I have a friend whose wife and daughter were shot down by the CIA and the Peruvian Air Force a few years ago, the Bowers. I have a friend, Gracia Burnham, whose husband Martin was killed when the Philippine Armed Forces tried to free them from rebels. You know, it is not unusual that people die. It's rare that people will die for somebody else, but it does happen. But the example is not human. The example is that the Bible tells us that while we, you and me, while we were still sinners, Christ died for ungodly people like us, that the God of the universe set the example of giving up our vendettas and giving our lives for other people out of love for the Father who yearns for his children. Minkai says all the time, God does not see it well that we should walk his trail, arubiki, alone. He says he loves all of his children, so don't be walking his trail without telling other people, oh, please, please, won't you please come and walk God's trail with me? It's not our trail, it's his trail. We can't change people, he can. But at the end of that trail, our names have been written in the Lamb's Book of Life, and if we find our name there, then we can live happily with God forever. And Minkai just, he yearns for people to do that. I do too, and I'm so thankful that people told me about that new trail.
Yes, absolutely. Steve Saint, thanks for your time on Open House tonight.
Thank you, Sheridan.
What a wonderful, wonderful story, hey? If you came in halfway through our chat with Steve Saint, remember, in a day or so, it'll be up on theopenhouse.net.au as a podcast. I'm sure you know a number of people who need to hear that story. You can email them the details or download it and pass it on to them, whatever you need to do. Steve Saint, whose father, Nate, died at the hands of the very man Steve is now best friends with, Minkai Yee. Amazing story. You can read it in the book and watch the film, The End of the Spear.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.